pull up a chair. I want you to stand with me for a second in a big, quiet building in Dayton, Ohio. It's cool in there. The light comes down soft on all that aluminum, and hanging in front of you, up on her gear, nose slightly high like she's still got somewhere to be, is a four-engine bomber painted in olive drab and gray, with a girl in a red bathing suit painted on the nose. That's the Memphis Belle. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar, the place where we sit down and tell the stories behind the airplanes. And today we're going to talk about one of the most famous airplanes in American history, and about the 13 years and thousands of hours it took to bring her back from a pile of corroded parts. Now, before I get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the coffee hot this morning. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And friend, if there was ever an airplane that understood that every milestone deserves to be marked, it was this one. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's go back to 1942. The airplane we're talking about is a Boeing B-17F Flying Fortress. If you've never stood next to one, let me paint it for you. She's big. Wingspan of about 103 feet. Four Wright Cyclone engines, radials, each one throwing out about 1,200 horsepower. Four of them turning at once on a cold English morning made a sound you felt in your chest before you heard it in your ears. A deep rolling thunder that rattled the Nissen huts and set every dog on the base to barking. She was built in Long Beach, California, and she rolled out of the factory in the summer of 1942. Serial number 4124485. Just a number. Just another fortress in a war that would build almost 13,000 of them. But this one got a name. And here's where it gets interesting. Her pilot was a young man named Robert Morgan, from Asheville, North Carolina. And Morgan was sweet on a girl back in the States named Margaret Polk, who lived in Memphis, Tennessee. Now Morgan wanted to name the airplane after his sweetheart, and the story goes that he and his crew had been to see a movie, a picture called Lady for a Night, and in it there's a riverboat called the Memphis Belle. That was it. That was the name. Southern girl riverboat sweetheart in Memphis. It all came together. They brought in an artist, a fellow working from a pinup drawn by George Petty for Esquire magazine, and he painted her on both sides of the nose, a pretty girl in a swimsuit, one leg kicked up, blue on the left side of the airplane, red on the right, and under her, in flowing script, Memphis Belle. Then they took her to war. Now I want you to really understand what these crews were flying into, because it's easy 80 years later to look at a clean airplane in a museum and forget the arithmetic. In 1942 and 43, the 8th Air Force was trying to prove a theory. The theory was daylight precision bombing. Fly deep into occupied Europe, in broad daylight, in tight formation, and put bombs on the factories, and the rail yards, and the submarine pens. The problem was that the German fighter pilots could see you just fine in broad daylight, and so could the flak gunners. A tour was 25 missions. 25. And in that first year, the cold statistics said that the average bomber crew did not live to see 25. The losses ran so heavy that a man doing the math in his bunk at night could work out that the numbers were against him ever going home. So let me put you in that airplane. It's 4 in the morning. Somebody shakes you awake in a freezing hut in the English Midlands. You eat your powdered eggs. You go to the briefing, and they pull back the curtain over the map, and there's a red string running all the way to some target deep in Germany, and the whole room lets out a groan. You climb into the Belle, and she is not comfortable. She is loud. She is cold. And once you climb up past 10,000 feet, she is deadly cold. 40, 50 degrees below zero inside that airplane. The waist gunners stood at open windows in that blast of freezing air for hours. Men got frostbite reaching for a jammed gun with a bare hand. You breathe through an oxygen mask, and if the moisture in your breath froze the tube shut, you could pass out and die without ever knowing you were in trouble. The smell inside was cordite from the guns, hot oil, hydraulic fluid, and the sharp rubber smell of the oxygen mask against your face. And then the fighters would come. Little dots that grew into Messerschmitts and Focke-Wulfs, flashing through the formation head-on, cannon shells walking across the sky. And the flak, those black puffs that looked so harmless from a distance until you flew into a barrage of them and heard the shrapnel rattle off the fuselage like somebody throwing gravel at a tin roof. That was a mission. And the Memphis Belle and her crew did it 25 times. They hit Wilhelmshaven. They hit Brest. They hit the rail yards and the submarine pens and the airfields. They came home with holes in the wings and holes in the fuselage. They went through several engines. They shot down enemy fighters. And on the 17th of May, 1943, they flew their 25th mission, a raid on Lorient, France, and they came home. They were among the very first crews in the 8th Air Force to finish a full tour and live. Now here's why you know her name. The Army Air Forces understood a good story when they saw one. And they had a filmmaker in England, a Hollywood director named William Wyler, a serious man who would go on to make some of the great American movies. Wyler and his cameraman flew on combat missions. Real missions. They shot color film from inside the bombers, and one of Wyler's own cameramen was killed doing it.
Out of that footage, Wyler made a documentary, and he built it around this one airplane and this one crew. He called it the Memphis Belle, a story of a flying fortress. It came out in 1944, and Americans sat in darkened theaters and watched real B-17s over real Germany, and they watched these 10 young men. And for a lot of folks on the home front, that was the closest they ever came to understanding what their sons were doing over there. The airplane and her crew came home to the States and went on a war bond tour, city to city, and the whole country fell in love with her. And then the war ended. And that, friend, is where the story almost goes wrong. Because here's the thing about famous airplanes. Fame doesn't preserve them. After the war, thousands of B-17s were flown out to the desert and chopped up for scrap, melted down into pots and pans and window frames. An airplane that had carried men through the worst skies in the world was worth more as aluminum by the pound. The Belle came within a whisker of that fate. She sat out in the weather. But the city of Memphis, the city she was named for, stepped up and bought her. For a while, she sat outdoors on a pedestal, and then in a pavilion, on the river, in the humidity, in the rain, for decades. And weather is patient. Weather always wins. People broke pieces off her for souvenirs. Birds got inside her, water pooled in her belly, the aluminum corroded. The paint faded and peeled, and that beautiful, famous airplane slowly rotted in the open air. Folks who loved her worried she was too far gone. Now here's where it gets interesting, and here's the part of this story I love the most, because this is a restoration story, and you all know I can't resist one. In 2005, the Memphis Belle came home to the Air Force. She was trucked up to the National Museum of the United States Air Force at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, and the museum's restoration team took one long look at her and rolled up their sleeves. It took them 13 years. Think about that. 13 years longer than the Second World War itself. Longer by a good margin than the Belle's entire operational career. These craftsmen, and that is the right word for them, took her apart down to the bones. Every panel, they stripped away decades of corrosion. They tracked down original parts, and when they couldn't find them, they made new ones by hand, matching wartime specifications rivet for rivet. They researched exactly which shade of paint, exactly where every stencil went, exactly how that Petty Girl was painted on the nose, blue on the left, red on the right, so that when she was finished, she wouldn't just be preserved, she'd be right. They didn't want a shiny museum queen that never was. They wanted the Memphis Belle as she looked coming home from Lorient in the spring of 1943, the little patched bullet holes. The mission markers stenciled on her flank, one bomb for every raid, a swastika for every fighter her gunners knocked down, the honest, hard-used look of an airplane that had been to war and back. And on the 17th of May, 2018, 75 years to the day after that final mission, they pulled back the curtain and unveiled her. If you go to Dayton today, you can walk right up under her. It's free to get in, by the way. The whole museum is free, which is about the best deal in all of aviation. And you can stand under those four big radials and look up into the belly of the ball turret, that awful little glass ball where the smallest man on the crew curled up for hours over enemy territory with nothing but a curved piece of plexiglass between him and 20,000 feet of air. And you can read the names. The crew, Morgan, the pilot, Varinis, the co-pilot, the navigator, the bombardier, the engineer, the radio man, the gunners, 10 young men, most of them barely into their 20s, who climbed into that cold aluminum tube 25 times and flew into the teeth of it.
Now, I'll tell you something that always gets me, standing there. Robert Morgan, the pilot who named her, he lived a long life. He came home, and later in the war he flew B-29s in the Pacific, and he named one of those after Margaret too. He passed away in 2004, just before the Belle came to Dayton for her restoration. And Margaret Polk, the Memphis girl, the sweetheart the whole thing was named for, she and Morgan never did marry. Life went another way, the way it does. But that airplane carried her name through the worst skies in history and brought it home, and now it hangs in a museum where it will be spoken aloud by strangers for as long as that building stands. That's the thing about these old warbirds, and it's why I get so worked up about the folks who save them. An airplane is aluminum and steel and rubber. It doesn't remember anything. But we do. And when a team of craftsmen spends 13 years bringing one back, rivet by rivet, what they're really preserving isn't the metal. It's the memory of 10 kids from 10 American towns who did something almost impossibly hard, and most of them didn't come home, and this one crew did. The Belle is a stand-in for all of them. Every fortress that got chopped up in the desert, every crew that didn't finish their 25. So the next time somebody tells you a museum is just a bunch of old machines gathering dust, you send them to Dayton. Have them stand under that red bathing suit girl on the nose and read the mission markers. And then let's see if they still think it's just aluminum. My thanks this morning to the National Museum of the United States Air Force, whose restoration division did the patient work of bringing her back, and to William Wyler, whose wartime film means we can still watch the real bell fly. If you want more of these stories, come find us at radiohanger.com. The airplane flew 25 and came home. Then a team of people made sure she'd stay home for good. That's a debt paid in full, if you ask me.
Blue skies, and go see her sometime.